Let's start the Coco Beware for the WWE Hall of Fame campaign. How about that?
Is he not in?
He is not in the Hall of Fame.
How is he not in?
How is he not in?
I'm conflating Cauliflower Alley with, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I want to say one thing.
Wait, it's Coco Beware, ladies and gentlemen.
I am in the WWE Hall of Fame in 09.
Thank you.
Let's get the record straight.
It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
I love you, Solo!
Mama Monster.
Conquered my home!
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me!
I'll speak, bitch. Come on now.
You have legs.
They've made Solo a monster.
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No.
I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want!
Welcome to episode 892 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, December 15th, 2024. I am the Solo Monster. It was a great week for New York. Maybe not if you're a Jets or a Giants fan. Two of the most embarrassing franchises in all of football this year. Yeah, the Jets are playing Tony Khan's beloved Jaguars today. They actually have a shot at winning a game today because the Jaguars suck too. Outside of that, though, the Mets lured Juan Soto over to Queens from the Bronx. $765 million over 15 years, including a $75 million signing bonus. Like, imagine being handed a check for $75 million just for signing a piece of paper. That signing bonus alone is higher than any contract any pro wrestler has ever signed by more than five times over. It really illustrates just how small wrestling is compared to other sports. Or maybe it's just the fact that unlike all other sports, wrestling doesn't have its own union. Right? There's no Players Association for pro wrestlers. There's no super agent in wrestling like Scott Boras. It's all very ridiculous, but as a Mets fan, I'm very happy that we won the Soto sweepstakes. Now all we need to do is win a championship. 26 years old, 15-year contract. He's not going to be playing like he is now in 15 years, but he doesn't have to. Just help us win a couple of championships, and it'll all be worth it. It was a great day in Queens, and it was a great day last night on Long Island. Because it was the return of Saturday night's main event. The return of an institution in the place where it all began. And the biggest moment didn't even air on TV. And no, it wasn't Kevin Owens assassinating Cody Rhodes. It was Jackie Redmond and Peter Rosenberg. They were interviewing CM Punk backstage. Punk was not even booked for the show, but when he heard about all the legends that were going to be there, he just had to meet them and had to have his picture taken with them. So they were talking about Coco Beware, who was in attendance last night. And Rosenberg said, you know, we need to start a campaign to get Coco inducted into the Hall of Fame. Which is a strange thing to ask, given that Coco is already in the WWE Hall of Fame. And he's on an actual WWE broadcast insisting that Coco is not. Now, Punk thought he was. And then he started to question himself and second-guess himself. He's like, well, maybe you're right. Maybe I'm thinking of Cauliflower Alley. Well, Coco was standing nearby, and he crashes the interview to set Rosenberg straight and let him know that he is, in fact, in the Hall of Fame. He has been in the Hall of Fame for 15 years. I had secondhand embarrassment for Peter Rosenberg, but good on Coco for standing up for himself. In the where the hell did this come from department, Tessa Blanchard is back in TNA, and she's back in the most LOL TNA way possible. You know, they begin the year by firing Scott D'Amore, and they end the year by bringing back Tessa Blanchard. So we're going to talk about that, plus the Rey Fénix drama with AEW that unfolded this week. Fénix has since gone radio silent on social media. And Chris Jericho makes a surprise appearance at last night's GCW show. So was it a work all along, or did they make nice and decide to work together? All I know is Ricky Starks is sitting at home right now, probably thinking to himself, you've got to be shitting me. Poor Ricky. If you would like to make a PayPal donation The place to go is thesolemonster.com. If you'd like to drop one for the holidays and get your name forever etched into these final shows of 2024, you can make a donation. The link will be at the top of the page there. And I've got to say thank you here up front to PB. And I want to say, as I did privately, happy holidays and a very happy new year to you and yours. Big B, Bryant Becerra, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soap, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, Iowan corn farmer, Jesse Lamphere, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Night Stalker, Nayef Alsafar, Best in the Game, Trey Porter, Killshot, Keith Hart, Tough Guy, Temjin Zephyr, who shared an interesting bit of information with me. His uncle served in the Panamanian military alongside Bobby Lashley's father. And they're even in the same veterans group in Texas. He says it's crazy because he's been a fan of Lashley since he debuted, and he never knew that his family had some ties to him. Small world. It is indeed a small world. That's very cool. Got to give an early birthday shout out to Tab, a.k.a. Abby Void, who turns 30 years old this Friday. He appreciates and loves his friends and family and the good people at Metroplex Wrestling for making him feel right at home. So happy birthday, brother. And show your role, Chris Ludeck. What could have been in wrestling? Episode 23, Mr. Kennedy as world champion. Looking at what may have happened had Ken Kennedy successfully cashed in his Money in the Bank contract at WrestleMania 23, or I guess that's where he won the briefcase. So he's got a brand new episode up on that. He's got a new feature on his channel called Match Analysis, which sounds very similar to the Match Anatomy feature I used to do here on the Sound Off many years ago. And his first episode of that covered the Bret Hart 1-2-3 Kid match for the WWF title on Raw back in 1994. He's got a couple of other ones up too, covering some AJ Lee matches. So just search for Chris Ludeck by name. That's L-U-D-E-C-K-E. Or what could have been in wrestling, and be sure to check out all the content that he has done so far. Little programming note for you. I will not be live after SmackDown this Friday because I will be in Queens, House of Glory, running its final show of the year, Live for the Moment, with the return of Matt and Jeff Hardy, taking on the former HOG Tag Team Champions main event, Midas Black and Jay Lyon. The Hardys will also be doing a meet and greet that night. Rey Fénix will be there doing a meet and greet of his own. Zilla Fatu defends his Crown Jewel Championship against Jake Something. Megan Bain defends her HOG Women's Championship against Ally Catch. Carlos Ramirez and Idris Jackson will battle inside a steel cage. And a lot more. There are some general admission tickets that are still available. HOGWrestling.net. Get them now before they're gone. Everything else is sold out. And while you're there, you can also buy tickets to our Chicago return on January 17th, where we have Absolute Ricky Starks making his HOG debut against Mike Santana. And our very first New York City show of 2025 is just 8 days later. Ricky Starks returns. That is at Final Warning. Saturday night's main event last night felt more like Saturday Night Raw or Saturday Night SmackDown, wrapped in just enough nostalgia to keep longtime fans happy. I am one of those longtime fans. I had a blast with that aspect of the show. There were no bad matches, but there were no great ones either. A lot of them felt like they could have used more time. But you got to remember, this is their first time back on NBC in many years. I mean, I know they were on Fox, so it's not like they haven't been on network television in years and years. But it was their first time back on NBC in a long time. I don't think that was a priority for them. You know, to go out there and put on a bunch of banger matches. They wanted to keep people's attention without going too long in each one. It's also the two-hour format. You know, you got 2 hours, five matches, most of which are title matches. And all those commercials, I mean, my God. So we weren't getting any long matches regardless. And we got The Body back on commentary. Almost 40 years after the first one of the Nassau Coliseum, to see him back on the show in the feather boa and the snakeskin jacket, which I did not realize until this morning, is the exact same jacket that he wore to the Predator premiere in 1987. Okay, so he's had that thing sitting in his closet for 40 years. But to see Jesse on the show with no mention of Vince McMahon, no mention of Hulk Hogan, the two names most synonymous with Saturday night's main event, that Jesse was there and they weren't, is just wild to me. I'm not saying I expected Vince to be there. I'm just saying the idea that Jesse Ventura, and after all the bad blood and, you know, he came back briefly all those years ago and then, you know, nothing. For him to finally come back, he's on this show and the other two are not. I mean, who would have thought? Hogan was busy. He couldn't be there. He was at the UFC show walking Colby Covington to the Octagon to get his ass handed to him. So that's what he was doing last night. And when I say walking him to the cage, he wasn't doing too well. He wasn't walking very well. You know, they had the various retro elements in the show. As Triple H said, it was going to be a throwback night. They had Obsession by Animotion for the intro. They had a very narrow aisleway instead of the usual stage. They had the old metal guardrails and red, white, and blue ring ropes. The referees were wearing the powder blue shirts and the black bow ties that they used to wear in the 80s and 90s. You know, it was like the old school Raws that they used to do. But with Jesse sharing the hosting duties with Joe Tessitore, they had a few cut-ins with them throughout the night. And he came back and did commentary for one match, and it was the most important match on the show. It was the main event. And I thought he did a great job. Jesse is 73 years old now. Jesse Ventura is not the same Jesse Ventura that he was when he left commentary in 1990. Okay, that would be impossible. But for the most part, he is the same guy. He sounds the same. He's still sharp enough where, you know, he's not leading the commentary team. He wasn't leading the team even back then. He was the color guy. So he doesn't have to chime in as often as a Michael Cole does. But they had Michael Cole, Pat McAfee, and Jesse. So it was a three-man booth. And McAfee, this was his first night back in a few months because he's been doing College Game Day. He and Michael Cole are going to be the team for Netflix when Raw moves to Netflix next month. McAfee last night, I mean, whatever. I mean, he was serviceable. And Cole was good, but Jesse was on point. You know, injecting some common sense commentary into the show. It felt like he and I were watching the same show. Whereas a lot of times their announcers have to play dumb or they don't point out obvious things that should be pointed out. And I feel like we're watching two totally different shows sometimes. Here you have Jesse. He's like, why isn't Owens going after the leg? Right? Cody wins and Michael Cole is celebrating. And Jesse is like, he cheated. Your champion is a cheat and your referees are incompetent. But it's what I loved about his commentary when he worked with Vince McMahon and when he worked with Gorilla Monsoon and they would cheerlead for the babyface, like openly, especially Hogan. Boy, Vince loved Hogan. No matter what he did, right? The king of the eye rakes. Hogan could do no wrong and Jesse would always point out how biased they were. Like, I'll never forget one of my favorite Jesse commentary moments ever. SummerSlam 89. It was Rick Rude and the Ultimate Warrior for the Intercontinental title. They're outside the ring, and Warrior, it's like early in the match, and Warrior has the belt, and he's hitting Rude with the belt. And Jesse is losing his mind over this. He goes, that should be a disqualification. How is that not a disqualification? And Tony Schiavone says, well, Jesse, it's outside the ring. And Jesse is completely incredulous, and he just says, so you mean to tell me that you can shoot somebody so long as it happens outside the ring? Because, you know, you're even dumber than Monsoon. Like, Jesse may have rooted for the heels, but he was always the voice of reason. And that's what he was last night. He was questioning Cody's tactics in the main event. He was questioning why so-and-so wasn't focusing on this body part or how they should go for the pin, don't play to the crowd, win the damn match. I'm glad Jesse is coming back for the next one. He's going to be there for all of the specials next year. And I'm guessing most of the other throwback elements, except maybe the music, are probably going to be gone. I don't see them doing throwbacks like this every single time they do a special. I kind of wish they would. Honestly, they should stick with the red, white, and blue ropes at least. Because I always liked that color scheme. And I don't know why. I mean, I guess now when they do the Great American Bash, which I think NXT does now, I think they still use the red, white, and blue ropes. But they need to bring that back. They definitely need to bring that back on a permanent basis. Triple H played it safe. as he did with Survivor Series last month. He played it safe with the match outcomes. There were no, like, if you predicted the show, and I tried to be a little outside the box with a couple of my predictions because I was kind of hoping. Like, I was hoping for a title change in the main event. I still picked Cody to win because I figured there's, you know, very little chance probably of him losing the championship. But, like, EO, like, I was kind of hoping there would be at least one. I was hoping there would be something, and there was nothing. If you closed your eyes, you could have predicted every single match on this show. No title changes, no big surprises, no big returns, nothing like that. They are clearly saving their heavy artillery for Netflix on January 6th. Like, all roads lead to Netflix, and they're getting, what is it, $5 billion from them? So, yeah, they're putting everything into that show. It would have been nice to see Kevin Owens steal a title win from the Golden Boy, but he basically did. If you think about it, he basically did without officially winning the title. He stole the title. Cody's big surprise, which wasn't really a surprise at all, was the classic Winged Eagle belt, which has been worn by all of the greats, Hogan, Savage, Flair, Bret, Shawn, Undertaker, even Steve Austin, briefly. He was the last one to hold it officially. It's an iconic design. I was glad Michael Cole shouted out Reggie Parks for it on commentary. They clearly used a replica off of WWE Shop, and not an old ring-worn belt, or even one of the deluxe replicas, which have the thicker plates. But it still looked great. It still looked great. It's my favorite belt of all time. I was very happy to see it represented again in all of its glory on TV. The match itself, we had not one, but two referee bumps. Kevin Owens introduced a chair into the ring, and was not successful in using it, but Cody Rhodes was, because the chair was laying on the mat, and for the finish, Cody saw that, and he hit a crossroads to Owens on the chair, and he got the win. Cody is supposed to be the babyface. Owens is supposed to be the heel, but Cody resorted to heelish tactics to win, and in doing so, they created some sympathy for Kevin Owens in the eyes of at least some of the fans, at least until the post-match angle, which did not air on TV, and that was certainly a decision. Not the first time we've seen Triple H do this. The exact same thing they did with Owens and Cody last month. Or I guess actually it would have been Bad Blood when he had Owens pull up in his Lambo in the parking lot after the show and beat the crap out of Cody in front of his bus. And then they tried to hide the footage. Like, at first they wouldn't even air it on TV. This is so heinous. We're not going to sensationalize this. We're not going to justify this by giving it airtime on our show. But it spread like wildfire on social media, and that really is the idea here. I wish it would have aired on TV, because what a great ending to the show that would have been, to draw people in. But they posted it on social media instead to drive up their social media engagement and to get people talking. That's the only reason why they did this. Owens attacks Cody from behind, and he gives him not just a pile driver, but a package pile driver. The first time that we have ever seen him use this move in WWE. This was a staple of his on the independent scene. It has been 10 years, at least, since we have seen this man use that move. That wasn't Kevin Owens in there last night. That was Kevin Steen. And then he picks up the Winged Eagle Championship, and he leaves with it. He stole the belt. He even stood on top of Cody's body at one point as Cody was strapped to a gurney. He couldn't even move. He couldn't defend himself. And he's standing on him. And people cheered. When Owens walked out with the title, people chanted, "You deserve it," at him. I don't think they were chanting that at Cody. I know some people thought, oh my God, these people are chanting, "You deserve it," at Cody as he's being stretchered away. I don't think they were chanting that at Cody, because that would be pretty fucking evil if they were. This man just got his neck broken. He's being wheeled out. People are chanting, "You deserve it." I mean, it's New York, so I suppose it's possible, but I think they were chanting that at Owens as he left. Then you got Triple H walking out from the gorilla position just as Owens was heading to the back, and Triple H he's angry, and he shoves Owens a few times, and he was not happy about what Owens did. So this is the second person now that Kevin Owens has crippled and sent to the hospital in an ambulance. I'm sure they took Cody to Nassau County Medical Center right down the road there on Hempstead Turnpike. Owens on Twitter reacted to WWE's tweets about the incident. Because unlike the thing with the tour bus, like, they're not shying away from sharing this. Like, they have plastered this all over their social media. And they uploaded the full segment to YouTube. So they posted something on Twitter about the attack. And then also a video of Triple H coming out to get in Owens' face. Owens himself replied, and he did a little bit of editing to the captions for each one. A little bit of a correction. He said, after getting screwed out of becoming the undisputed WWE champion by incompetent referees, Kevin Owens justifiably gets retribution on the American person with an often imitated but never truly duplicated package pile driver, just moments after Saturday night's main event goes off the air to send everyone home happy. And then, about the Triple H video, he says, upon leaving Gorilla, Triple H enthusiastically thanks Kevin Owens for the house and tells him how proud he is of Kevin for doing what needed to be done and taking what he truly deserves, and proceeds to invite him over to his house for Christmas dinner and to watch Saturday night's main event back on a 734-inch TV. Owens is now using an old image of him holding the Winged Eagle belt as his new profile picture. He has stolen, he has kidnapped the Winged Eagle and is claiming it as his own. I love it. I love it because it means we get the belt back for a little while longer. This was only supposed to be one night only. And I really did. I thought that this was not even going to survive the night. I thought Owens was going to destroy the fucking thing. So it means that we get the belt back probably into early 2025. Now, I know it's not permanent. It should be. But it won't be. But we get it for more than one night. And Owens can now walk around claiming to be the real world champion, right? The uncrowned WWE champion. Just like when CM Punk came back to AEW and he had the world title and he spray painted a giant X over it, right? I mean, his last match at Wembley, that was against Samoa Joe. He was defending his title, right? He was not officially the AEW champion, but that was the story they were going to tell with Punk until eventually, I'm sure they did some kind of unification. Never got to that. But it's the same concept. Owens can do the same thing now until Cody comes back. And so in the meantime, even though he didn't actually win the title, he gets to walk around as champion and pretend that he is, while Cody convalesces at home. It's like getting a title change without an actual title change. And that's as close as Kevin Owens is going to get to becoming WWE champion. Now, I wish they would have just had him win if that was the case, right? You could do all the same stuff that you did. You could do the ref bumps. You could introduce the chair, let him hit the pile driver and win with it. But they're telling a story here of Cody using the chair to win and Owens feeling like he was screwed out of the belt. That's the story they're telling here. The story is that Kevin Owens is justified in the eyes of some people anyway. He has a justification for doing what he did. If they did it the other way, then he's just cheating to win. He's like every other heel. So they chose to do it this way. Now they're going to have another match out of this. It's either going to be, I think it'll be on the next Saturday night's main event, or maybe the Royal Rumble. Because the next Saturday night's main event is a week before the Rumble. They're going to have some big match for that show. I see it on either of those shows. I just feel like the first Netflix Raw is going to be packed enough without the need to do it there. But I guess that's also possible because they're loading that show up. Randy Orton got dropped with a far less devastating pile driver, and he has been out of action now for a month so far. How long are they going to keep Cody out after a package pile driver? I mean, we should not be seeing this man again for the rest of the year. He at the very least, he has to be gone for the rest of 2024. Right, there's not a lot of shows left, but at the very least, you got to keep him off television. I don't even want to hear from him for the rest of the year. Will Nick Aldis or Triple H suspend Owens for what he did? I mean, if you think about it, why wouldn't they? What he did was after the match. It wasn't even in the course of the match itself. Like, if it was like a non-sanctioned match or a no-holds-barred match or something like that, you could argue, well, all's fair, but he attacked the champion after the match was already over and tried to cripple the man. Why wouldn't they suspend him? What I want to see is a segment with Owens and Triple H this Friday, but the show's already been taped, so we're not going to get anything in the arena with them. I'm sure that would have leaked by now. So it doesn't look like we're going to get that on SmackDown. Does Randy Orton come back before Cody and go after Owens first? does Cody come back and then Orton comes back and they do a triple threat match. I would actually prefer that they don't do that, just because when we do finally get Cody against Randy in the ring, I would prefer that it be one-on-one. But these stories here, like, these are the best stories. It's the ones that blur the lines where it's not just black and white. This is the good guy. This is the bad guy. Sometimes good guys do bad things. And the bad guys may do bad things, but that doesn't mean that they're wrong. I personally would not get too hung up on Kevin Owens not winning the WWE title, right? I was disappointed that he didn't. I would have had him win, but I wouldn't get too hung up about him not winning, because he may be the de facto champion for the next month or so anyway. Like, he's still involved in the top program right now, outside of the Bloodline stuff, the top program in this company. He's being featured in a great spot. So while he may not officially be recognized as the champion, he's basically going to be the champion, I think, for at least the next month. The original plan was to close out the Seth Rollins-Bronson Reed program on last night's show, which I'm sure would have been a loss for Bronson Reed, because Bronson Reed is not the one headed for a match soon with CM Punk. So maybe there's a small silver lining in there for him, but not much of one. He had surgery on his broken foot this week and is expected to be out of action for several months, very likely missing WrestleMania. Even if he was to make it back in time to be on the WrestleMania show, there's not going to be enough time to get him back on TV and build a story for him, so he's out of WrestleMania. And that sucks. And I could have seen an Intercontinental Championship win in his future, but if so, that's on hold now. But because Reed was to have wrestled Rollins on Saturday night, they needed a backup plan, and that backup plan was Drew McIntyre, who got called back a lot earlier than expected. And that's why we ended up with the McIntyre match with Sami Zayn last night, where he beat Sami clean with a claymore. He is clearly targeting Bloodline members, or at least the people that teamed up with CM Punk in War Games. Walking back from the match, there's a video he posted on his own Twitter account. And in the video, as he's walking, he goes, one down, four to go. Sami is the one. Who are the other four? Jimmy and Jay, right? That's two. They've already been attacked by Drew, so we know that's two of them. Who are the other two, though? Is he referring to Punk and Roman? Like, is he really going to go after CM Punk again? Are we not done with Drew McIntyre and CM Punk? Do we need to go back to this? Or is he referring to Roman, maybe, and Solo? He could be going after both of them. We don't know, but one down, four to go is what he said last night. Liv Morgan retained her Women's World Championship over Io Sky clean. Beat her clean. There was no interference from Raquel. There was no interference from Dominic, even though they were both there. And then after the match was over, Rhea Ripley came out. We had a little face-to-face, clearly building to January 6th. On Netflix, where I would expect Rhea Ripley is going to win back that Women's World Championship. I don't know what Io's chances are of winning the Royal Rumble. If she had won the title, then she wouldn't have been in the Rumble, and she would have probably gone into WrestleMania as the defending champion, but she didn't win here. She should be in the conversation, at least. I don't know that her chances are great when you have Charlotte Flair on her way back, when you have Becky Lynch probably on her way back, probably on January 6th, we'll see her there. I don't know what that means for Io, but she deserves to at least be in the conversation. Gunther retained his World Heavyweight title over Finn Balor and Damian Priest. That was the match of the night. And he, when I say he, I mean Gunther, he saved Damian Priest's life. There was a spot near the end there where he was to have given him a powerbomb on the ring steps, the flat part of the ring steps outside. As he went to lift up Priest for the powerbomb, Priest has got those long fucking legs, and his foot hit the steps, and it kind of stalled his momentum as Gunther was trying to lift him. So Gunther, he still has him, but he didn't get him up. So he kind of waits a second, and then he muscles him up, and then he delivers the powerbomb. But, you know, anytime you get a guy that big upside down like that, that could end very scary. I mean, not that Gunther is going to just drop the guy on his fucking head, like Nash did with the Giant at Sold Out. Still one of the scariest things I've ever seen. But apparently Gunther was getting some praise behind the scenes for saving the spot and protecting Priest. And then he got in the ring and he finished off Balor, shotgun dropkick, and then a powerbomb with a stack, and he pinned him. And that should put a period on this as far as Finn Balor and Damian Priest going after the World Heavyweight Championship. It's time for Gunther to move on. I don't know who's next. I don't know who that next challenger for him is going to be. They haven't really set anybody up for it, unless it's fucking Goldberg. And then as far as Balor is concerned, he and JD McDonagh are defending the tag team titles against the War Raiders on Monday night, and I expect them to lose those titles, right? He lost last night. He loses on Monday. Now he's in a downward spiral, and that, I think, ultimately leads to him being booted out of the Judgment Day by Dominic Mysterio. I think that's where this is headed. We had the finals of the women's tournament to crown the first ever women's United States champion. They made history last night. Chelsea Green against Meechan. Chelsea Green had her first match in TNA, we were told last night, against Meechan. TNA got two mentions on commentary on NBC last night, no less, by Michael Cole. And they had an average TV match, but with a great finish. And they set it up where Chelsea was on the ropes, and Meechan was standing on the mat, and she managed to reach down, hook her arms, and then Chelsea floated over right into position for her finish. And she hit the Unpretty Her, she pinned Meechan, and she got a nice ovation from the crowd on Long Island. Of course, it's Long Island. She has a certain connection to Long Island, even though she's Canadian. And she becomes the first ever women's United States champion. So I thought the finish was great, even though the rest of the match, like I said, was average at best. This is a woman who, when you look back at how she got to where she is, right? She started in Tough Enough many, many years ago. But when she finally made it, you know, to WWE, she had a very difficult time with injuries. And it was her wrist. I think it was both the left and the right wrist. And she broke her wrist, I don't know, two or three different times. And she had to have surgery. And you start to wonder, like, is she just not going to be able to, you know, work more than a few matches without getting hurt? Is she injury prone, or where's her career going to go from here? Is WWE going to sour on her? They're not going to trust her because they think she's made of glass. Like, you worry about stuff like that. So she overcame that. She ended up getting cut and then eventually made her way back to the company. Yeah, I mentioned this last night where she's told the story about how she texted Triple H directly and said, hey, you know, was there a spot? Like, she took the initiative and said, I want to come back. I'm ready to come back. And they brought her back. And I think she's had a good year. And it culminates with her winning her first singles title here in WWE. She's very entertaining. That's why the crowd, I think for the most part, the crowd was positive when she won last night. It's not like they were booing Meechan out of the building, but they don't have a connection with her the way they do with Chelsea. Chelsea's very entertaining. So for her, that was a huge moment last night. I thought that was very cool to see. Two men who were not present on last night's show were CM Punk and Seth Rollins. And Chris Featherstone of Sports Kita Wrestling first broke the news, which has since been backed up by Mike Johnson of PW Insider, that the current plan for January 6th is for CM Punk and Seth Rollins to wrestle each other on that first Raw show on Netflix. Not only that, but it will take place on that show in the main event. It will main event the show. A show that also now includes tribal combat between Roman Reigns and Solo Sikoa. Doing the first Punk and Rollins match on that show does not necessarily mean they are not doing it at WrestleMania. This is just the first. You honestly think they're going to do CM Punk against Seth Rollins on January 6th and that's going to be it? It's going to be one and done? This story has been playing itself out now all year, off and on. This was going to be the WrestleMania match this year. But the night that Punk came back a year ago at Survivor Series, they made it very clear that Seth Rollins was not happy about it, right? He was cussing up a storm. He was freaking out. Some of the promo segments they've had on TV this year, and then this week alone, you have Punk basically saying, hey, this guy has tried to do everything that I've done. He's followed in my footsteps. He's won the same championships that I've won, but I did it better. Your second string, you know, when the main star comes back, second string, you sit down on the bench. Rollins' response to all this was to talk about how, yeah, I looked up to him. He trained me, and I looked up to him for many years, considered him a friend, and then he ghosted me. When he left this place, he ghosted me, among other people. Let me down. Disappointed me. So if they do the match on January 6th, you got to look at it as the beginning of a program. It's not the the end of one. By the end of it, I think we're going to have one clear babyface and we're going to have one clear heel. And that heel is going to be Seth Rollins. More than CM Punk, it's going to be Seth Rollins. And I like it. Look, we need some big matches on TV. That's a big match. They don't have to save all their big matches just for PLEs. You want to make that first show a big deal, you need a match like that on there. Now, Roman Reigns against Solo Sikoa, that's another one. I would much rather get that match now than at WrestleMania. The first tribal combat they ever did sucked. That was between Roman Reigns and Jey Uso at SummerSlam last year. Jey is super over, but he really needs a redemption match. Tribal combat sucked. The match with Jimmy at WrestleMania this year was no good. So yeah, Jey needs a real good match soon. But I hope this tribal combat is better than that one. You know, Bloodline rules at WrestleMania, that was great. Bloodline rules at SummerSlam with Cody and Solo was not. But this time it's Tribal Chief versus Tribal Chief with the Ulafala on the line, or as LA Knight called it on Friday, the Ufalafa. And I could see this going one of two ways. To me, it's one or the other. If Solo Sikoa is going to win this match, it could be with an unlikely assist from Drew McIntyre. Why would McIntyre do anything to assist Solo Sikoa? Right? The man who helped cost him the WWE Championship 2 years ago? Because Roman Reigns is probably his next target. What did he say last night? One down, four to go. Since he came back, McIntyre has attacked Jey Uso. He's attacked Sami Zayn. He attacked Jimmy Uso on SmackDown Friday night. It's very clear who he's going after here. Now, maybe McIntyre costs Punk a win against Rollins on that first Netflix show. He's going after Punk. Because as I said before, four to go, we know the Usos are part of that. But who are the other two people? Is it Roman and Punk? Because both of them, it looks like, are going to have pretty big matches on January 6th. He may go after both of them. That would suck if he interferes in both matches. Like, I don't need the same person interfering in both of those big matches. But I'm just saying they're right there, right? They're both going to have big matches on January 6th. He could go after both of them. If he's referring to Roman and Solo as the other two, he can get involved in that match and attack both of them. And it could be a no contest and we have no winner. And they have to run it back later on, maybe at the Royal Rumble. But if Roman is on his hit list, it could be the way Solo beats Roman if they don't do a no contest. If the plan, though, is for Roman to win, and we're not going to see McIntyre, if Roman's going to win, and they don't want to drag this out any longer with him in Solo, then that should be where they shoot the angle to have Solo Sikoa viciously attacked and kicked out of his own bloodline by Jacob Fatu and Tama Tonga. Tonga Loa is out right now, so is Bronson Reed, so that bloodline has shrunk. You know, maybe they debut Hikuleo as part of the group at that point. But there has to be consequences for losing. Solo told Tama Tonga in August, after Roman came back, if Roman can take the Ulafala from him, then Tama Tonga will acknowledge Roman Reigns as his tribal chief, as will he. And Tama seemed taken aback by that. Solo went in there at War Games, and he lost for his team. Now, if he loses the Ulafala to Roman, that's it. It's game over. There's no reason for them to acknowledge this man anymore. They kick his ass. Does Solo have to go crawling back to Roman Reigns? Do they swerve us and have Jacob and Tama acknowledge Roman and they all attack Solo? Then Roman leads the new bloodline, leaving Solo and the Usos to reunite and try to fight them off? I mean, Roman hasn't exactly changed his ways. It's not like he's suddenly some great babyface. Who's to say that he doesn't go full heel again? Maybe he never apologized to Jey when he, you know, came back because he's not sorry about the way he treated those guys. And he's not going to apologize for something that he's not really sorry for. Speaking of which, I'll get to Tessa Blanchard in a bit. But those are the two big matches it looks like right now. As far as January 6th, they're going to add more again. Rhea against Liv for the women's title seems like a gimme for that show. But they're going to be loading it up. It's going to be like a PLE that night, only with commercials. And Mark Shapiro, the COO of TKO, he attended the UBS Global Media and Communications Conference on Monday, and he commented on the possibility of even more PLEs shifting to the two-day format beyond just WrestleMania and SummerSlam. He said there's definitely an opportunity for that. It's all a progression, a natural evolution. And he added that expanding depends on the partner involved and that they're in a good place with their storylines and how they weave them throughout the year. I already told you guys, like when the SummerSlam news was first announced that it was going two nights, and now we know it's going to be two nights at MetLife Stadium next year and then two nights in Minneapolis in 2026, I told you the Royal Rumble is next. They've got two Royal Rumble matches. They're going to be able to build a bigger card each night around one Rumble, right? The women's on one night, the men's on the next. It's inevitable. They've already sold 45,000 tickets for next year's Royal Rumble, and we're still 2 months out. The Rumble is going to be next. It's going to be a test. If that test goes well, after that, it's going to be Money in the Bank, and then it's going to be Elimination Chamber. It's only a matter of time. This is going to be the new format, unless their business just completely cools off. And you would have to think at some point it's got to cool down a little bit, but there's no sign of that happening anytime soon. It's only a matter of time before they move to the two-night format for all of their major shows. Now, there hasn't been a lot of great news for AEW lately, but this is something they can hang their hat on. On Monday, they held a public on-sale for tickets to All In Texas at Globe Life Stadium in July. And 7 months out from the show, they have already cleared over $1 million in ticket sales, making it the highest North American gate in AEW history, topping last year's Forbidden Door show in Toronto. Now, we don't know how many tickets they actually sold. The belief is that the number is only around 6,000 or 7,000, which for a stadium show is not great. But $1 million is $1 million, and that's the starting point. Sting was there at the event, as was Bryan Danielson, both of whom got chants from the small crowd there of one more match, one more match. Sting is not wrestling one more match. He's done. He's stung. Danielson is more of a question mark. His neck is all messed up, and he's trying to avoid surgery. He's doing stem cell therapy treatment first, so he hasn't even gone under the knife yet. He's not sure when or if he'll be able to wrestle again, but he said he'll definitely be a part of All in some way, whether he's just working backstage or if he's doing commentary, however Tony Khan wants to use him, he'll be there. At the event, Sting said that his retirement match at Revolution this year was the greatest night of his 40-year career because his sons had a chance to be involved. So he would rank that number one on his list. And think of the big matches that Sting has been involved in across multiple promotions, going back all the way to the 80s. This is his number one. Well, likewise, Danielson says that his Wembley match with Swerve Strickland was his favorite moment because he had his family there to be part of it. One thing that Tony Khan does well is giving some of these legends the chance to go out there and have those moments. You know, the respect that he paid to Sting and the respect that he continues to pay to Bryan Danielson, obviously he thinks the world of him, it's to be commended. To his credit, it's one of the things that Tony Khan gets right. Chris Jericho made an appearance, a surprise appearance, last night at the GCW show in Los Angeles, a show that Ricky Starks was originally booked for before he got pulled. Jericho attacked Matt Cardona, who is challenging Jericho for the Ring of Honor World title this Friday at Final Battle. And he attacked Effie, who was one of the big stars in GCW, one of their biggest. Cardona was wrestling Effie when a man in disguise hit the ring, and he nailed Cardona with a baseball bat, leading to Effie hitting a Rough Rider and pinning Cardona. Effie had a confused look on his face until Jericho pulled off his mask to reveal his identity, and then he dropped Effie with a Judas effect. Then he took his sweatshirt off, and he revealed an AEW shirt underneath. Now, Effie made headlines a few weeks ago for some comments he made about Tony Khan being paid by his father to stay away from his other businesses, and he dragged the company for being able to operate while running at a $40 million deficit While other companies like GCW, we can't afford to run at a $40 million deficit. Whichever comment it was, it obviously irked Tony Khan, and he pulled Ricky Starks from three dates that he had booked himself with the promotion, one of which was to be last night, another one being GCW's Hammerstein Ballroom return on January 19th. And the word was that no AEW talent would be allowed to work with GCW going forward. So it was very strange last week when Matt Cardona was brought in as the surprise opponent for Jericho at Final Battle because he's one of GCW's main stars. And there was also some news this week about Willie Mack being pulled or pulling himself out of a scheduled GCW date. I think it was going to be last night because of all the drama that was going on, which turned out to be a very weird deal because, first of all, I didn't even know that Willie Mack was under contract with AEW. I had no fucking idea. Evidently, he wrestled for Ring of Honor a few times this year, but his last match was a loss to Commander back in October. Like, he worked far more for TNA than he ever has working for AEW. So, finding out that he was under contract with them was a shock. AEW denied to Sean Ross Sapp that they pulled Willie Mack from the GCW show. And they said that GCW is lying about it. GCW, meanwhile, said, well, Willie wasn't directly blocked from showing up, but somebody in AEW encouraged him it would be best not to take the booking. And the belief is that that person was Christopher Daniels, who works in talent relations for AEW. But the angle last night, it calls everything into question now as far as whether or not this was all just a work from the start, or if they mended fences and they put their issues behind them for the sake of doing business, which would be the smart way to go. That would be the wise move for all involved. Especially because guys like Ricky Starks and Willie Mack, they're just trying to get booked. Like, they may be getting paid by AEW to sit at home and do nothing, which is a great use of your talent budget, by the way. But these guys want to work. They want to get their names out there, and they want to work. They're not a bunch of freeloaders. So they go out and they book themselves, and they end up getting caught up in some childish drama that they have nothing to do with. Is the Jericho thing an olive branch, or was everybody in on it from the start? I don't know. Maybe they worked everybody from the very beginning. I sure hope it was. And if it wasn't, they need to let Ricky Starks rebook those remaining dates with GCW. Because if Ricky had no knowledge of any of this, and if he legitimately got pulled, only for AEW to then send Chris fucking Jericho to GCW, that is a level of pettiness beyond anything that I have seen from Tony Khan. And I've seen a lot of petty shit, but that is just, that's a whole new level. I mean, I thought the Rey Fénix stuff was bad. But that would just be ridiculous if that was the case. So hopefully they get that shit straightened out. And now this has me wondering if we might get an Effie appearance at Final Battle this week. Speaking of Jericho, Jim Ross, who says that his health has greatly improved, which is great to hear. His physical health may be better. I question his mental state after these comments that he made on his Grilling JR podcast, praising Chris Jericho as the MVP of AEW. He said, when you see him on AEW, you see good work. You see a smart program. He gets to book his own stuff more often than not. Well, that explains a lot, doesn't it? I've said many times, arguably, over the last 2 or 3 years, that he has been kind of the MVP of AEW because he has stayed in place. When you see Jericho, you just don't look away because you know something is going to happen and it's going to come out of his mind. He would make a great booker, no doubt about it in my mind. Now, if you're referring to his importance to AEW in its infancy, absolutely. He was one of the MVPs of that company. They needed a name like Jericho to get themselves established on TV. But to say that about Jericho in 2024 is just beyond ludicrous. Saying that when you see Jericho, you don't look away because you know something is going to happen. Look, people can't look away from a car crash either. That's why rubbernecking is a thing. Considering how much lower their ratings have gotten this year, it seems a lot of people are looking away. I mentioned Rey Fénix before. On Saturday, this is last weekend now, Phoenix had responded to a fan on social media who complained that he was not being used on AEW television. And he wrote, "I will have my chance to speak the truth." And then he added, "No one stays in a place where they received inhumane treatment." And then later that same day, Penta made a surprise appearance at AAA's TV tapings. He did a farewell speech. So clearly he is either signed or will be signing somewhere very soon. Wink, wink. Early Monday morning, Phoenix again began making some very cryptic remarks online, alluding to mistreatment by AEW. He said, "I needed a doctor, and you ignored me for months." And then he responded to an update that was provided by Chris Featherstone of Sportskeeda. And to this report, Phoenix said, "So far, this is the most accurate comment." But what Featherstone wrote was, "I received information from an AEW source on November 20th regarding the Lucha Brothers status, but did not report it as I was waiting for one of them to begin speaking their mind about the situation. I was told that was coming. I also was told that day that Penta's contract was soon ending with AEW. Ray Phoenix did just do that. He spoke his mind. So here is some intel that I received. The alleged excuse that Tony Khan found out about the Lucha Brothers being in talks with WWE is fake news, and the real reason will be revealed. There is a real story behind the situation with Ray Phoenix, which is a huge injustice. Expect the Lucha Brothers to go more in-depth about their time in AEW when they are free and clear to do so, and when they do, it is going to be ugly." And also in response to that post, Phoenix added, "Unfortunately, due to contractual issues, I cannot speak now, but I will have my time." Fightful Select said, "One source admitted that there have long been communication issues, but had not heard of anything that would be construed as inhumane, and had not spoken to Phoenix about it. They had heard that Phoenix took issue with a doctor who had not cleared him at one point, although context on that was not exactly complete." By Wednesday, Phoenix deleted all of his tweets, alleging inhumane treatment and about needing a doctor and being ignored. The only tweet left is the one saying that he will have the chance to speak his truth. Everything else after, which I think was on December 9th, everything else after that is gone. Inhumane treatment is a pretty strong statement, and he's going to have to back that up at some point. He also left it vague enough that it could have technically been referring to something other than AEW, but that would be pretty irresponsible of him to do that, knowing the first thing that people would assume is that he would be referring to AEW and that they would shit all over Tony Khan for it. So if it has to do with something unrelated, then he should have clarified that, and I think he would have clarified that. He didn't, because he's clearly referring to AEW. And that is a major accusation to leave hanging out there. Now, he did delete the tweets, and the question is, did he delete the tweets because somebody got to him and told him, take that shit down? Or did he realize that it might come back to bite him, or that it might even make WWE a little bit nervous to have this man going public with, you know, stuff like this on social media and being a bomb thrower. So he just decided on his own that it would be best to take the tweets down. We don't know. This is my read on this, okay? And that's all this is. This is my read on the situation. I think that what happened here, Phoenix is trying to put pressure on Tony Khan to release him early from his contract. He wants out, and he is desperate, and he is going to do whatever it takes to get out of this fucking contract. Either that, or he is just trying to get fired so that he could join Penta in WWE. This was part of his plan to put pressure on Tony Khan for all of the bad publicity that he would get from this, to try to make this go away as quickly as possible. The problem is, Tony Khan and AEW, they get so much bad publicity and hate every single day that I don't think Tony really cares. I really don't. I think he is numb to it by now. Now, some of the negativity is justified, and there's also a lot of negativity and hate lobbed at him that isn't. But as he has said before, to be AEW is to be constantly under attack. There is a lot of truth to that statement, rightly or wrongly, whether you feel like a lot of that, you know, being under attack is justified or not, that is the truth. So I think Phoenix said, fuck it, let's dangle this carrot out there, and it didn't work. Now, if we take what he said at face value, right, I needed a doctor and you ignored me for months. We need more context to this, but just take that statement at face value. That sounds deplorable. Like if this man was injured, and at one point he was out and he had what he called the worst injury, the most painful injury of his career. I think it was a hip injury. If this man was injured and he tried to get help from AEW and it fell on deaf ears, it's just hard for me to picture Tony Khan intentionally ignoring his request for help if he was actively trying to get help for an injury that he had. I know CM Punk in his interview with Ariel Helwani accused AEW of ghosting him after Brawl Out to the point where he had to go out on his own to find a doctor and pay for his tricep surgery because nobody called him, nobody called to check in on him. And when Tony was asked about those allegations, he said that, well, we typically do pay those expenses, and he said that I'll have to look into that. He wasn't sure. You're not sure? How can you not be sure? He was the biggest star in your company. I mean, it's not Lee fucking Moriarty that we're talking about here. If Roman Reigns gets hurt in WWE's ring, if Cody Rhodes gets hurt, if Rhea Ripley gets hurt in their ring, do you think Triple H is not aware of whether or not the company took care of their surgeries? He said he would look into it. I don't know that we ever actually got a follow-up to that, whether or not they did or did not pay for his surgery. Punk says they didn't. So maybe I shouldn't be so surprised if that's what happened here. The difference is Punk, you know, he sat at home, he was waiting for them to call him, and they never did. So he said, well, the hell with this, I'm going to go out and get this taken care of on my own. If Phoenix was reaching out or calling people, texting people, and being ignored, and he can prove that, that's a horrible look for Tony Khan. And Phoenix would have every right to be upset, because if there was a delay in getting him the treatment that he needed to get back in the ring, then it's not right for Tony to add injury time to his deal and extend him for another year, which is what it's believed to be. He may have had as much as a year added onto his deal. Is that what happened here? Or was it a case where Phoenix was ready to return and he couldn't get AEW to medically clear him? Maybe he felt that he was ready, AEW didn't, and because of that, he's upset that Tony added all of this time to his deal when he feels like, hey, I should have been allowed back in the ring a lot sooner. It's not my fault. Your guys didn't want to clear me. I kind of feel like it's one or the other that we're looking at here. So which is it? We don't know. And it may be a while before we find out. If we ever find out, I mean, the power of the NDA, we may never find out, but it may be a while before we can find anything out, because Phoenix isn't talking and Tony Khan doesn't look like he's in any great rush to let this man walk right into WWE, which is really what this is all about. I mean, at the end of the day, that is what this is all about. He added that time because he knows as soon as he's free, he is going to WWE. And it would be one thing if he had plans to use him, but he doesn't. He's got him sitting at home collecting a paycheck to do nothing. Like the WCW guys who had those sweet Turner guaranteed contracts and they opted to collect their guaranteed money rather than go to work for Vince. Except I'm sure whatever Ray Phoenix is making, he's not making Hulk Hogan money. He's not making Kevin Nash money. That's one of the big differences. On Dynamite Wednesday night, we got the return of Toni Storm after Mariah May beat Mina Shirakawa, but not timeless Toni Storm. We had the return of the OG, the punk rocker, Toni Storm. And then it was announced that she was going to have her first match back in months on Rampage, which is being canceled in 2 weeks. And this greatly upset some people on social media. Even Brian Alvarez reported hearing from multiple people within AEW who were left scratching their heads over that decision. But I watched the match that she had with Harley Cameron on Friday, and then I saw her match with Shazza McKenzie from Collision last night. Between that and her backstage promos, she's either doing an amnesia angle like Cactus Jack in WCW, or it's timeless Toni Storm's greatest performance yet. And she's playing the role of OG Toni Storm, pretending like she just signed with AEW for the very first time. After her match last night, she got on the microphone and she said that she was proud to announce that she is officially All Elite. So we are not done with Timeless Toni Storm just yet. I thought we were, but I'm loving where this is going. She's so good at this. She really is. I thought, like, okay, she's done all she could do with this character. It's time to evolve. It's time to move on. But she's added a whole new layer to this now. Like, there was a promo in the back where she was talking about how amazing it is to finally live her dream and be part of a roster with people like Mercedes Moné and Willow Nightingale and Hikaru Shida. And then she looks over and she spots Mark Briscoe standing off in the distance, and she shouts at him, all excited to introduce herself. And the way the camera just pans over to Briscoe standing there with, like, the biggest what the fuck expression on his face. Like, it was priceless. Priceless. I don't know if the idea behind those two wins on Friday and Saturday is to build her quickly, which is why they wanted her immediately back in the ring winning matches, because they want to set up a title match with her and Mariah at World's End. Or if the plan is to hold off and do Mariah against Thunder Rosa first, because they kept showing Thunder in the crowd during the main event on Wednesday. But it's not worth getting bent out of shape about her wrestling on the Dead show when it's very likely that her real return is yet to come. Like, the return that we got in the ring on Friday, like, that's not her real return. I think we're looking at Timeless Toni Storm returning in time for their Australia show and facing Mariah May on that show. Alvarez also mentioned that Luchasaurus is said to be doing much better after his bout with double pneumonia in his lungs, and he is working towards making a comeback, which is great news. It sounded pretty dire there for a little bit. And I don't know, man, after the Brody Lee stuff 4 years ago and the stuff with his lungs and everything, like, just the way they were talking and how bad it was, like, your mind goes to, like, these terrible places, and it's like, man, I hope he can pull through, and sounds like he is. Apparently, Luchasaurus is crediting Tony Khan and AEW Medical for telling him to stay home the week before he collapsed, because he collapsed in his house and had to be rushed to the hospital. That's how this all started. And I don't know what it was, if maybe he was telling them he wasn't feeling well or they thought he didn't look well, but they told him to stay home the week before, and I guess he feels that may have ended up saving his life. While speaking to the Covalent TV YouTube channel at the recent WrestleCade convention, AEW star Camille was asked about her goals in the company. And she acknowledged that so far in her AEW tenure, she has not had the opportunity to show off her personality, basically putting the blame on AEW and agreeing with critics who say that she lacks any sort of personality. She said, "I still feel like the AEW world hasn't even seen a glimmer of what I have to offer. Even being able to, now mind you, she's saying that she's been on television now for fucking 5 or 6 months. She says, even being able to talk and show some personality. I'm really excited for AEW fans to get to know me a little bit better. It's about introducing that side of me to the fans. If someone says, oh, there's no personality, I mean, to be honest, I would agree with them up to this point because I haven't really gotten the chance to show it. So I'm just really excited for everyone to see that I'm more than just standing there making faces." She was being as diplomatic as she could be in saying basically, yeah, you're right. They haven't really done shit with me. They haven't allowed me to do anything. But now after saying this, I'm not sure that that's going to make Tony Khan all of a sudden want to do more with her. She may have just buried herself even further. Look, I thought it was a great idea bringing her in the way that they did. It was something I pitched a long time ago. And I just thought it would make for a great introduction for her. In that role, she would not be showing off a lot of her personality because the idea was you bring her in as the enforcer for Mercedes. She's the muscle. She stands there. Mercedes can hide behind her when need be. And when she does get in the ring and wrestle, it's short matches. She goes in there and she smashes people. And you do that for 6 months. You do that maybe for a year. And you build a story around that where as you get deeper into the story, things start to break down between the two of them. And, you know, Mercedes starts to really call her names and insult her. And, you know, very similar to how things broke down in the end with Shawn and Diesel. And you build to the eventual split, at which point you've now invested so much in this that people hopefully at that point will actually care when Camille does break away from this woman, and now you've got a ready-made challenger for the TBS title. Like, that's the story that I envisioned, and that's the story I thought they were going to tell. What Tony Khan did was he used this as a way to introduce her to the world, and then after 3 months, they rushed through this fucking 6 or 9 month angle, and they rushed to the very end of it when they just didn't invest enough time in it for people to even care. And it didn't help that in those last few weeks before they did the split, they made her look like a complete fool. Then, of course, they did this mystery attack. They did their own version of a Jade Cargill backstage whodunit, who attacked Camille a few weeks ago. And who knows now when we're going to see her back on TV. Probably not for a while. So had they followed through on the idea in the way that I think it was originally, or at least in the way that I originally conceived of it, yeah, she wasn't going to be able to go out there and show off too much of her personality, but I do think in the end it would have worked out a lot better for her. And then when the split finally did happen, she would have had a chance to stand on her own and show off more of her personality and do more promos. But I just think they were so impatient that they just didn't take the time that they needed to really get her set up for that success. And now I don't know what kind of success she may end up having in this company. She may have no success at all. I hope for her sake it works out, you know, it works out a lot better than I think it's going to. I think the use of Camille in AEW should be studied for what not to do with someone coming off of an 800-day run as the NWA champion. Now let's talk about TNA here. TNA brought back Tessa Blanchard this week. And it has been 4 years since her last run there, where she became the first woman to ever win the TNA World Heavyweight Championship. So she wasn't just a knockout champion, she was the World Heavyweight Champion. I guess back then it was still the Impact World title. And because I have seen so many comments online in the last 48 hours asking, why do people hate this woman? What did she do? Why does she have so much heat with so many wrestlers? I don't know what she actually did. I think a history lesson is important because there's a reason that you have not heard Tessa Blanchard's name much in the last 4 years. And it's not just because of one incident in Japan 7 years ago. You know, there aren't too many times where you can point to one tweet. I mean, a lot of wrestlers have tweeted out a lot of stupid shit over the years. But someone who burned their career down to the ground with a single tweet. Not very often that you see that, but that's what happened on the eve of Tessa Blanchard's match with Sami Callihan when she won the Impact World title. And the tweet that she put out the night before simply said this: hey women, try supporting one another. Cool things happen. That one tweet led to multiple wrestlers coming forward to talk about what an awful, terrible person she was to them and to others in the wrestling business. And this was across multiple promotions, multiple countries even. Allison Kay was the NWA Women's Champion at the time. She tweeted back, remember when you spat in a black woman's face and called her the N-word in Japan? Was that you supporting women? The audacity of this tweet. Chelsea Green, who just became the first women's United States champion last night, co-signed that tweet and chimed in with her own thoughts, claiming that Tessa has consistently put down, bullied, and belittled countless female co-workers, including her. Is that support? To which Tessa called her a clout chaser and said that it wasn't true. So she denied it. Isla Dawn chimed in and said, as someone who experienced your bullying firsthand, received regular verbal abuse, was spat on, had rumors spread about me, dealt with multiple attempts by you to blacklist me from other companies, and more, I just pray that you now follow your own advice. Then there was Rebel from TNA and later on AEW, who confirmed the stuff from Japan, as did Shanna from AEW. Priscilla Kelly, who's now Gigi Dolin in NXT, she said that Tessa publicly put her down on social media for something that didn't involve Tessa whatsoever, and then dragged her name to other people over it. there was a battle royal where she got into supposedly a legit fight and then allegedly came back into the locker room and called every woman there trash. There was a story about her bullying Drake Maverick's wife, right? Rockstar Spud, at an indie show. Even the woman in question with the Japan story that she allegedly spat on and called the N-word, La Rosa Negra, she said the incident happened in 2017. Through all of this, Tessa has never admitted to anything publicly. She has never apologized publicly for anything. And to take her at her word that these were all lies, damn lies, would be to call all of these other women liars. Like, they all just decided one day, they woke up one morning and they decided to conspire against her. When, had she kept her mouth shut and not tweeted what she did, it's very likely that none of this would have even been discussed. But it was so hypocritical that they just felt they couldn't stand by and bite their tongue and let it go unanswered. And that's when the floodgates opened. It's not like there weren't already stories out there about Tessa Blanchard. I mean, you can go back to the first Mae Young Classic and WWE opting not to sign her. Now, she did go on to beat Sami Callihan for the Impact World title and then had one title defense against Taya Valkyrie, and that would be her last. Then the pandemic hit, everything got shut down. But through it all, TNA stood by her, and they figured, hey, we could wait this out, and all the outrage would eventually die down. Her contract was expiring a few months later, and they ended up firing her. They fired her. They fired their world champion before she could effectively quit because they knew she probably wasn't going to re-sign with them. You know, leaving your world title on someone whose deal is expiring is another classic TNA move. But she was living with her fiancé at the time in Mexico, and she was scheduled for two television tapings for them, which she never appeared at. Supposedly, she was worried that if she left Mexico, you know, with everything going on, she might not be able to make it back into the country. So instead, they tried to at least get her to tape some promos from home and send them in so they could splice them into the show, and she couldn't be bothered to do that either. So they had to scramble at the last minute and re-edit the show and cut new voiceovers for the hosts. They tried to get her to come back to at least drop the title. Once it became clear that was not going to happen, that's when they fired her. I don't think it helped her cause that all of this went down right as the speaking out movement happened in wrestling. And, you know, speaking out was a separate issue, but no wrestling company was going to touch anybody controversial at that point. Like, as talented as she is, and nobody is denying her talent, like, why would WWE not snatch her up immediately? Right? Ask yourself that question. Third generation star, the daughter of one of the Four Horsemen. I mean, Tessa against Charlotte seemed destined to headline one night of WrestleMania in the next few years. Why would WWE not touch her? Why would Tony Khan not bring her into AEW to be the face of his women's division, which at the time was really struggling and could have used someone like her? The two biggest wrestling companies in the world, neither one of them would touch this woman. Why? Because she was radioactive. She was only 24 years old when all of this went down. That's a lot of baggage for a 24-year-old. She clearly made a lot of enemies in a very short period of time in her career. She made quite the impression. And through it all, there was no mea culpa. The woman that she spat on and called the name has since forgiven her for it. They even took a picture together and posted it on social media a while back. I am assuming that Tessa apologized to her personally for what happened. And honestly, that's really the only person that she would need to apologize to if she did that, because that's horrendous if she did that. But all of the other people that have claimed to be bullied or harassed or blacklisted by this woman, there's still, to date, never been any kind of acknowledgement by Tessa that she did anything wrong, or she can understand why people would have taken that tweet back in 2020 to be the gold standard of hypocrisy, right? She's never owned up to any of that. Not to say that everybody would forgive and forget if she did, but I think that would have gone a long way in terms of her career. She may be working right now for one of the major companies in this country, had she done that. Instead, she doubled down. And even after all that, She signed on with WOW, Women of Wrestling, after they got a syndication deal with CBS. Remember that? They got AJ Lee to be the face of the show. Tessa was going to be their top star. It would have been the biggest stage for her in her entire career. And she crashed and burned there, too, before the shows even started airing on TV. There were reports that she cut a promo on one of the wrestlers there in a class and really tore into this girl, like tore her to shreds, which led to other trainees speaking up in her defense. Then the classes got canceled, and the news came out that Tessa was no longer in charge of training talent. It caused a major shift in all of the plans that they had for the show. Like, you hear that, and you think, well, it's just Tessa being Tessa. Didn't do much to rehab her image, let's put it that way. And that whole project probably would have been like a Tessa Blanchard rehabilitation project, and she squandered it. She's 29 years old now. She's been working in Mexico for CMLL for the past year. And as far as I know, she's been a model citizen. There have not been any new stories that have come out about her. Nothing publicly has been said, you know, negative. When Stephanie Vaquer left CMLL for NXT over the summer, she left without dropping her titles, including the CMLL women's tag team titles. Tessa and Luvia, they won a tournament for them back in August. And now, once again, one half of the tag team champions has left the company without dropping the titles. And CMLL announced her departure this week and declared the titles vacant. Our old friend Vacant is back. This boy has been getting his passport stamped. He's been brushing up on his Spanish, I see. So they stripped her of the title because she signed a deal to return to TNA. In a deal so secretive, even the talent in the TNA locker room did not know about it. Sean Ross Sapp says a lot of the talent there were blindsided by the news. That's because the company intentionally kept the news away from much of its roster and even some higher-ups in the company to avoid any potential backlash. LOL TNA returns. We need to hide this from the people who work for us because there could be backlash to it. So we're going to do it anyway. What could go wrong? If you think that signing someone might cause a backlash so significant that you feel you have to hide it from people, that might be a sign that you shouldn't bring that person back. According to their sources, the decision to re-sign her came from a top person at Anthem, despite warnings from others in the company. So basically, somebody in Anthem and not from the wrestling side is the one who made this decision. And the plan was for her to return as a heel to feud with Jordynne Grace. And I presume beat Grace on her way out of the company, as I would be shocked if she doesn't sign with WWE when her deal is up, which is in the next couple of months. And so at their final resolution show on Friday night, Tessa did indeed attack Jordynne Grace during Grace's match with Rosemary to give Grace the win by DQ. I saw a report from someone with Post Wrestling, I think, who was there in the building on Friday night, who said that everybody in the building knew. Like, they had already read the news about Tessa, and they knew she was coming in. And when she did show up, the reaction was mostly negative. Like, not necessarily in a way where, oh, she's a heel attacking someone that we like. It was more like, ugh, you know, not her. Mike Johnson says, internally, reactions have been mixed. While some within TNA remain supportive of Blanchard, others have expressed discomfort with her return. Grace, for instance, reportedly pushed back against the idea of working with her, though she is still set to face Blanchard as part of the company's storyline plans. One source shared that the hope is for Blanchard to remain on her best behavior, as this marks her biggest opportunity in years. However, the move has drawn skepticism, with one source stating, "The news was kept quiet for a reason. They didn't want to deal with the fallout until the plan was in motion." I wouldn't be surprised if Tommy Dreamer was among the people advocating for her to come back. I know he was very supportive of her in the past. I know Moose is another one who went on Twitter and said that he was happy to have her back. You know, to risk the morale of your locker room for someone that really is not going to make much of a difference to their business, not enough to really matter. Like, in the big picture, it's a questionable choice. But I could see why they would want to do it. They have lost some people, and they stand to lose even more soon. Like, Rhino just announced that he is gone from TNA. He's not retiring, but he's no longer in TNA. Speedball Mike Bailey, he left last month. Jordynne Grace, she's going to be on her way out soon. Okay, Josh Alexander, same thing. or at least he's going to test out the free agent market, which is what he wanted to do this year before they rolled him over for another year. So would not at all be shocked if Alexander is gone, Grace is gone. They've taken a hit in their knockouts division this year. Naomi, obviously, earlier in the year went back to WWE. Deonna Purrazzo, she left for AEW. Giselle Shaw left not too long ago. Steph DeLander had spinal fusion surgery. She's been posting about her recovery. So they lost her. And Jordynne Grace is very likely leaving. So in their mind, they probably feel like, well, we need a new face for the division, and Tessa can fit that role for them. Right? Jordynne Grace doesn't want to work with her, but she's willing to be a team player because what does it matter if she's leaving anyway? Right? Just do it and get it over with, and then you'll be gone. She's been a great flag bearer for that company. Great representative for TNA, especially in her appearances in WWE. I think that she deserves better on her way out, as opposed to being forced to work with somebody like Tessa and put her over instead of putting over somebody already on the roster, like a Masha Slamovich or somebody like that, who has put in the work and by all accounts is well-regarded. But this is what TNA wants. It's a risk. She has clearly made a lot of enemies, and a lot of it is of her own making. When you treat people like shit, that has a way of coming back around on you. Her not acknowledging things publicly was the worst decision that she could have made. When you have a dozen different people who all have their own stories of things that were done to them or said to them or said about them that potentially harmed their career, things they witnessed, when you have that many people, right, you can't ignore that. You can field an entire baseball team with the number of people that have come forward over the years with Tessa Blanchard stories. Now, I believe people can change. They can grow. They can mature. Especially when, you know, you're in the earlier part of your career, not near the end. But you have to demonstrate that first. She had one good year in Mexico. Now TNA is going to give her the chance to do the same here. I'm not even saying that she doesn't deserve the chance to try to prove herself. You know, for her sake, she better not fuck it up because TNA is giving her a shot. Because for her, I think what this is a dress rehearsal for WWE or AEW. I think this is the first step. If she can put in a year or two without any incidents, I do think that they would give her a look. This is a chance for her to show that she can be on her best behavior. You know, TNA squandered a lot of goodwill with fans when they fired Scott D'Amore. Then you pull a stunt like this, bringing this woman back in the dark of night like a SEAL Team 6 mission, and you risk alienating people, especially heading into a year where they've already announced major shows for New York and LA. Right? They got a lot of tickets to sell for those shows. Time will tell if any unhappy faces backstage or any bad PR that they're going to get out of this can be offset by generating business, because that's really all Anthem cares about. Can this woman help generate business for us? TKO cares about making money too. This is going to be a test run. They're going to let TNA be the guinea pig, and if she can do business for them, then they'll want to have a conversation when it comes time for her to be a free agent again. This is the biggest opportunity of her career. She better not squander it. With the news of Vice Media launching its own sports division, we got the announcement that Dark Side of the Ring will be returning in 2025, and we have a premiere date, Tuesday, March 25th. That's when Season 6 will premiere. This is part of Vice TV relaunching with a sports-first commitment, airing other shows like American Ninja Warrior and Arena Football, and new series like Dark Side of the Cage, which is assumed to be an MMA-focused series similar to Dark Side of the Ring. Per Greg Oliver at Slam Wrestling, while no topics have officially been announced, through the last few months, he says, they've been collecting clues through various contacts and believe these to be some of the subjects. So, again, these are not confirmed yet by Vice. There's been no schedule put out, but this could be what Season 6 is going to look like. There looks to be an episode on superstar Billy Graham, who, of course, had a very interesting life, a very interesting career. He passed away in May of last year. And You know, look, he's somebody who is an important figure in wrestling history, more, I think, than anything he ever did in the ring for the people he influenced. And you have people like Hulk Hogan and Jesse Ventura, who was out there with a feather boa on Saturday night's main event just last night, who copied this man. They were influenced by Billy Graham. They copied him. And obviously they became bigger, or at least Hogan did become bigger stars, but for that reason alone, he was a very influential figure in the business and a very tragic one because, you know, all that success, and it was squandered by all of the steroid use, and not even steroid use, steroid abuse. And his body just completely broke down on him. And I'm sure that'll be the big dark portion of the story. But man, he has had so many near-death experiences over the years. There's been so many stories of him needing... He had like a liver transplant many years ago and needing this surgery and that surgery. And he always seemed to kick out until one day he just couldn't. So that'll be the story of superstar Billy Graham. Test is apparently going to get an episode devoted to him. He passed away in March of 2009 of a drug overdose. Test is somebody, when he first got pushed in WWE, he looked like he had superstar potential. You know, I still look back fondly on that program and that SummerSlam match he had with Shane McMahon. And then he was just in like a prime position, man. He was going to marry the boss's daughter and storyline and look like maybe he would go on to feud with Triple H. And they just blew him off. And he never, from that point forward, and he spent many more years in the company, but he never attained that same level of stardom ever again. Eddie Gilbert, second generation wrestler. Says, Eddie followed his father, Tommy Gilbert, into pro wrestling, as did his brother, Doug. An incredible mind for the wrestling business, but was somewhat undersized for the time period and used whatever means necessary to get bigger. He died of a heart attack in Puerto Rico in February of 1995. Two topics that I pitched after the end of season 5 looks like they may be in the works on Daphne and Ludwig Borga. On Daphne, that's just a very sad story. You talk about tragic. I mean, look, you could argue Billy Graham and all the steroid abuse and everything. Yeah, I don't know if tragic is even the right word. I mean, he did it to himself. But Daphne, it's just a sad story. And I, in the very early days of the podcast, there was an episode. I want to say it was episode 155 or 150. It might have been 157, but whichever one it was, I think that was the one where yeah, I just went on about the kind of abuse, in many ways, of the female performers in TNA, and Daphne was kind of chief on that list, and the things she went through and getting concussed and injured, and it was awful, you know, what she went through, and she fought through many demons, and she passed away in September of 2021. If I remember, I think she took her own life. But I said, like, Daphne is, unfortunately, the perfect subject for a show like Dark Side of the Ring. Because when I think of her, you know, she was the Scream Queen in WCW, right? She goes all the way back to the WCW days. But I just remember, like, Daphne, and she had, like, that big smile. And to think that she went from that, which is what I picture in my head, to being somebody who, obviously, at the very end, was not doing a whole lot of smiling, and for her life to end the way it did, was tragic. So if there is an episode on her, I think it's appropriate. Ludwig Borga is, for very different reasons, I think another good topic for a show like this. I don't recall him being terribly well-liked. You don't hear too many positive Ludwig Borga stories like, oh yeah, that guy was a riot, man. He was so much fun to hang out with. He kind of came out of nowhere, but he didn't just wrestle. Like, he wrestled and he did strongman, and he may have done MMA or some kind of fighting. He served, I think, in the Finnish parliament, so he became a politician. He was a fucking Nazi. I mean, yeah, dark side of the ring indeed. And he passed away in 2010, so that may be an episode. Billy Jack Haynes is another one. He is currently in jail in Oregon for allegedly murdering his wife at the beginning of this year. And if I remember that story, first of all, Billy Jack, he's not all there. Okay. He's definitely got, he's definitely a few French fries shy of a Happy Meal. But his wife also, I think his wife was very sick. And I don't recall exactly what the illness was, if it was dementia, Alzheimer's. It might have been dementia. And so there was talk about maybe this was like a mercy killing. Because you hear like, oh, you killed his wife. You think, oh, he flew into a rage and he killed his wife. As I recall, I don't have all the details of the story in front of me right now, but I think he was basically her caretaker. It sounded like he needed a caretaker of his own, but it may have been a case where she was very sick or she was suffering, and that's why he killed her. I don't know, but he's behind bars right now. I don't know, you know, what his status is or where that case currently is, but he was a big star back in the day, like in the Pacific Northwest. I remember him from WWE when I was first, you know, a fan. I was very young, but he wasn't like a major star in the company. You know, he was a mid to upper mid card level guy. He never held a championship. He was never featured too prominently. My biggest memory of Billy Jack Haynes is probably the match with Hercules, where he got busted open with the chain at WrestleMania 3. Like, you know, I don't have a lot of other Billy Jack Haynes memories, but he was definitely a bigger star in some of the other territories. And he was a very colorful person, because in the last like 10 years, 15 years, like go check out a Billy Jack Haynes shoot interview and some of the wild stories and the wild conspiracy theories. Like, he knew how to tell a story. Now, whether or not you could believe that story, that's a whole other thing, but he was definitely a storyteller. Vader, it looks like, may be getting the dark side treatment. And, you know, I don't know. You could point to stories, I guess, in his life, like the fight that got him fired from WCW, and maybe the latter part of his life. I don't know if there's anything terribly dark, but there's stories that you could tell about his career, about his push being killed, basically, by Shawn Michaels in WWE. I also think about that match he had in Japan. I forgot who it was. Oh, it was with Hansen. It was with Stan Hansen, where his eye popped out. He had to push it back in. Ugh. Yeah, he's had a very interesting career. This one reminds me, though, maybe more of like a John Tenta type episode, where there isn't anything overly dark, but he definitely lived an interesting life. So I'd want to watch that. And then the other one that is rumored is an episode on Hell in a Cell. Now, it looks like they try to have at least one episode like this every season, kind of more of a lighthearted episode. They did one on the Brawl for All. I don't know, like, an episode on Hell in a Cell? Like, you know, what's it going to be about? How violent the match is? Like, that to me seems like one of those weeks where you kind of take off from watching the show. I get them wanting to have some topics that are maybe not as dark, but I think you could do one on the Heroes of Wrestling pay-per-view, the worst pay-per-view of all time back in 99. Like, why is that not an episode? Anyway, there's also talk of an episode devoted to Mick Foley, based on Jim Ross saying that he was interviewed for it earlier this year. So that doesn't mean that it's going to make the cut. I mean, there's been talk over the years of them filming stuff for a Mike Awesome episode, and his ex-wife apparently got that squashed. Not that it wasn't true, but that the episode would not be done because she didn't want it to be done. I don't know if they needed her cooperation for it or what, but so, I mean, there's been talk about episodes that were going to happen and then ended up not happening. But Mick Foley, I mean, I guess it would just focus on how broken down he's become from all the crazy bumps and all the abuse that he's taken over the years and that he's put himself through. Which, in that case, I guess that means in season 14, we'll get our Darby Allin episode of Dark Side of the Ring. I'm looking forward to covering the new season. I cover every season, and I will cover this one as well, as I have the previous five. At the end of last season, I talked about possible ideas, because in wrestling, there really is no shortage of them. If this Slam report is true, that would seem to cover most, if not all of them. But, I mean, there's so many other topics. Like, you could do one on Scott Hall. Problem with that is that you're never going to get the people you need for it to sit down and be interviewed. Like, you can, right off the bat, you can eliminate anybody from WWE, like Shawn Michaels and Triple H. Kevin Nash is not going to do it. Waltman might. Maybe they could get his ex-wife Dana or his son Cody, but it just seems unlikely. They could do episodes on Rick Rude. You could do an episode on Ashley Massaro, which is another sad situation. Rock and roll Buck Zumoff, the piece of shit that he is. You could do one on him. Sweet and Sour Larry Sweeney. I mention him every year. See, I think some of the lesser known names could make for some of the best episodes. Because you'd learn a lot coming out of it that you didn't know going into it. A lot of these other topics, like especially me, I've talked about a lot of these stories before. Like I already, I would say 95% of the stuff that I hear about in these episodes, I already knew or I've talked about on the Sound Off. And then I get excited with the other 5%. It's like, oh, I didn't know that. But that's kind of rare. So I feel like you would learn more from someone like a Larry Sweeney, who a lot of people are not going to be familiar with. He was a wrestler and a manager on the independent scene who a lot of people were making comparisons to Bobby Heenan. And he was very young when he took his own life. It's a very sad story. I think he was bipolar. I don't know. Maybe he wasn't on his medication, whatever it was. But he had his demons and they got the better of him. And what a waste of talent. What a waste of life. I think he would have gone on to have a very successful career. And I think people would be interested to learn more about somebody like that. So chime in. You may have names that I'm not thinking of. Maybe even some lesser known ones that you think people might want to hear about. So chime in and let me know what you might want to see on Dark Side of the Ring. Let's get to some mailbag questions before we get out of here. You can always email me, thesolemnmonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Sam from New Zealand. Been listening since episode 40. Hey, the Sound Off was number one in New Zealand this week on Apple Podcasts for all wrestling shows. See, the Kiwis love me. And I love them. At Survivor Series this year, I got a two-man power trip vibe when Roman and Punk shook hands. And as WWE just released a Mega Powers video on the Vault channel, I'm thinking of how fun and unexpected it would be for Punk and Roman to be the Mega Powers of 2025, managed by Paul Heyman. What do you think of the chance of this? Or what the chance of this is? And how would you book it? Think about how much it would piss off Rollins. Rollins would have to form his own army just to take them down. It's an interesting idea. It's not going to happen. The chances of it happening are, I mean, it's wrestling. You can't ever say zero, but it's next to zero. Okay, it's not going to happen. How I would book it, I mean, look, if you're going to take the two biggest names in the company, I mean, outside of Cody, it's Roman, it's Cody, and it's Punk. If you're going to take the two biggest names in the company and put them together, they're going to dominate. Which means there's going to be a lot of people who are going to be doing a lot of jobs and they're going to be, you know, wrecking shop, and you're going to have to put together some kind of a rival force. That's why I said Rollins gets together maybe with like a McIntyre, Kevin Owens, like they would have to all come together to try to take these guys down. It just doesn't work though. Like it doesn't fit. Well, Punk's character, like why would he do that? You know, he's friends with Paul Heyman. And there's that favor, by the way, that Heyman owes him that we still don't know about. But the idea of CM Punk like forming an alliance with Roman Reigns and then being kind of like a modern day two-man power trip is so, it just flies in the face so much of CM Punk's character and what he represents on TV. I just can't see it working. Mike in Lakeland, Florida, with all the nostalgia and excitement surrounding Saturday night's main event, what are your top three steel cage matches in WWE history involving the fabled Big Blue Cage? Ah, Big Blue. Well, you know what my all-time favorite steel cage match is, and the greatest one in WWE history, Bret Hart against Owen Hart, SummerSlam 1994. A lesser known one I'm going to throw at you right now is the Steiner Brothers against Money Incorporated for the tag team titles. That was in 1993. They had many matches in 1993, many of them not televised, and they swapped the titles back and forth a few times. That cage match, though, that should have been the SummerSlam match that year. But DiBiase was on his way out. I guess they wanted him to do the job in a singles match to put Razor Ramon over. To really solidify his babyface turn, they turned Razor face coming out of the embarrassing loss to the 1-2-3 Kid in that whole angle. DiBiase started mocking him for it on TV. That's how we ended up with babyface Razor Ramon. And that match with Razor at SummerSlam was DiBiase's, I guess that was his second to last WWE. I was going to say that was his swan song, but it wasn't. That was his second to last WWE match ever. And you may be thinking, second to last? I thought it was his last. Not true. He technically won a battle royal on the Raw 15th anniversary show. He paid off IRS to eliminate himself so that he would win the battle royal, one of the all-time great, clever battle royal finishes. Unless you are a newer fan, though, you probably watch that and think to yourself, why did the businessman-looking guy jump over the top rope for the other old guy? And that makes me sad. So he lost to Razor, and the Steiners, I think, wrestled the Heavenly Bodies on that show. But that cage match really should have been on that show, not the SummerSlam Spectacular or whatever they called it. I think it aired on USA the week before. That was a great match, and that was televised. And it was a unique one for its time. You did not see many tag team cage matches back then. So I would say that's one. And the other one would have to be the Triple Threat cage match at Breakdown in your house, September 98. The Rock, Mankind, and Ken Shamrock. I think that's an underrated gem. I'll throw another one at you. I mean, you said three. I'll give you a fourth one. Hulk Hogan against the Big Boss Man from Saturday Night's Main Event 1989. That was the blow-off to their feud. Hogan and Boss Man, let me tell you something. These two guys, you know, as far as like Hogan opponents, Hogan and Boss Man, they drew a lot of money together, taking that cage match on the road, around the horn, all the live events. And every single night, they did that superplex spot off the top of the cage. And those mats back then, they were like concrete. They had no give. Those are two big bodies to be landing on those mats from that high up every single night. More so Boss Man. I mean, he was really the one taking the brunt of it. Although Hogan is the one who ended up with 11 back surgeries. But Tony Schiavone said the greatest match that he's ever called in his career was Hogan against the Boss Man in the cage at Madison Square Garden. And this is how ridiculous that road schedule was back then. Okay, I want you to pay attention to this. The day of that Madison, and the Madison Square Garden show was not Saturday Night's Main Event. I'm just saying they also did a cage match at MSG. Schiavone called it. He was new to the company at the time. It was him and Lord Alfred Hayes. He says his favorite match he ever called. The day of that MSG show, WWE ran five shows that day. Five. They ran three matinee shows and then two shows at night. So they had crews all over the place. Like when Hogan and Boss Man were working MSG that afternoon, Randy Savage was working the Ultimate Warrior in the main event somewhere else. Jake the Snake and Andre the Giant, they were headlining somewhere else. And then that night, Savage and Warrior, they worked each other again. Poor Randy Savage. And Hogan and Boss Man, they ran the cage match back again later that same night. This time they went to the Boston Garden. So they sold out MSG with it, and then they sold out Boston with it. So Boss Man took that superplex bump and he bled a gusher in that Madison Square Garden match. And then a few hours later, it's put a Band-Aid on it because you got another one to do. It's just crazy. It's just insane the schedule they worked back then. And on those mats, it's no wonder so many of those guys are all crippled up now. Joey from Melbourne, Australia. I don't know how it works in America, but in Australia, all employers are required to have insurance to cover their employees if they get injured at work. My job is to help people who have been injured return to their jobs. In my experience, the biggest thing that stops people from going back to work is when their boss doesn't communicate with them after they've been injured or support them. Why would someone want to go back to a boss who doesn't take the time to call or help their employee get back to work? This is probably why some of these guys want to leave AEW. When CM Punk first mentioned he wasn't contacted by anybody at the company when he was hurt, I too thought that it had to do with the brawl out issue. But now after hearing Rey Fénix and Ricky Starks, who isn't even injured, are also experiencing the same thing, it is clearly a management problem. If AEW doesn't fix this, they will find that there are other talents who want out when their contract is up. I'm a big fan of AEW. I bought tickets, flights, and a hotel room to go to Grand Slam. But the management clearly needs work. So yes, in this country, you are required by law, I think it's in all but one state. I think it's, like, if you're a business, you're required to offer what they call workers' comp. Okay, workers' compensation for employees who get hurt on the job. I think Texas is the only state where if you're a private company, you're not required to buy the insurance. Yeah, we actually talked about this, like, at work a few years ago. I don't even remember the context in which this came up, but this is why I know about it. But yeah, I think in Texas, if you're a private company, then you're not required to buy the insurance. But look, I've been talking about the issues with communication in this company for 2 years now, going back to Brawl Out and all of the events that led up to it with Punk and Hangman and Colt Cabana and the rumors going around and people blaming Punk and Punk insisting I never said anything. And then Tony Khan apologized and said, oh, I should have nipped this in the bud. You know, I'm sorry. Yeah, you should have. There have been communication issues in this company going back years. And then you hear stories like this where Ricky Starks is being interviewed by Chris Van Vliet and saying, I don't know. I don't know why I'm not being used. Nobody's talked to me. Nobody said anything to me. I sit home and I want to work and nobody talks to me. And I think, how is that possible? He's not just some jabron. I mean, in terms of AEW, he was making a name for himself. He was pretty popular. He was one half of the tag team champions. And yeah, I get that Tony thinks he's as good as gone when his contract is up and he's friends with Cody and Jade and he could see the writing on the wall, but evidently he still has some time left on that contract. And the fact that there's been no communication. How is that possible? The Rey Fénix situation that I talked about earlier. Willie Mack and the GCW thing where, you know, and again, we'll find out if that whole thing ends up being a work or not. But, you know, did they really clue in Willie Mack? Was Willie Mack part of the work? I'm thinking not. And evidently he didn't know. Like, well, I don't know. They didn't tell me that you can't do the show, but it was kind of told to me without telling me that you probably shouldn't do the show. And I'm like, if this is real and you don't want your people working for this other company, you have to communicate that to them. You have to send out a memo. You have to send out a group text. You have to put something on the fucking bulletin board at the building. You have to do something, a team meeting, and say, hey, here's the update. Here's what you need to know. So there's no questions and there's no confusion. There's no embarrassment. But they don't do that. It's like people are just left to fend for themselves and they just have no idea. Are they asking questions? Are they doing their part to try to get answers to those questions? Because it goes both ways. It's not just a problem on the AEW end with their management. It could be an issue with talent. Sometimes the talent doesn't ask questions. That's a problem. Me, I mean, forget about it. I'd be the biggest pest in the world. I'd be the biggest pain in their ass until I got the answers I'm looking for. If you don't stand up for yourself, nobody else is going to. If I don't ask the questions, nobody else is. But there have been communication issues clearly with the management in this company for a very long time. And I really think a lot of their problems could be avoided or could be solved by simply talking to each other. David from Sacramento. This week on NXT, the mystery of who attacked Eddie Thorpe was concluded in the most genius heel way possible. He attacked himself and got himself a title match as a result. As we continue to wait for the outcome of the mystery of who attacked Jade Cargill, I wanted to ask for some of your favorite mysteries in wrestling. I know the number one answer is who ran over Stone Cold, or at least the investigation. So what are some of your other... I never said that was my favorite. Don't put words in my mouth now. I don't know where you're getting that from. That probably would be number one in terms of, like, the most visible whodunit angle, because Austin was the biggest star in the freaking world. It's not my favorite. What are some of your other favorite? By the way, I did see the Eddie Thorpe segment. I saw it on YouTube, and it is quite genius that he was able to avoid, you know, lasting 25 minutes in the Iron Survivor Challenge to get a shot at the world champion. Well, NXT champion. And all he had to do was just fake an injury and pretend that somebody else attacked him. And then Ava, the general manager, felt so bad about it that she handed him a contract for a title match. It makes Ava look completely incompetent at her job, but it makes Eddie Thorpe look like the smartest man in the world. The biggest and the greatest mystery story of all, in terms of wrestling, is easily who was the third man in the NWO angle. Like, Hall and Nash come into WCW. They're hyping up a third man. We don't know who the third man is going to be heading into Bash at the Beach. Ultimately, it ends up being Hogan, and we get the formation of the NWO. I mean, period, end of story. That's the greatest mystery angle that's ever been done. And it had the greatest payoff, too. I'm going to throw another one at you. The reveal of Vampiro as Pentagon Jr.'s master in Lucha Underground. I don't remember if it was season one or season two. It might have been the end of season one. That was great. And honestly, there aren't very many others that I can think of. The problem is so many of them have been letdowns. You know, who ran down Stone Cold? I did it for The Rock. Right? And then later we find out it was Triple H. It was the most obvious choice. But like the Rikishi reveal was just, it was just dumb. The Higher Power was stupid. I remember being disappointed by that. Paul Roma as the Fourth Horseman. I mean, they were kind of stuck, I guess, because it was supposed to be Tully, and then he got popped on a drug violation, so they ended up not bringing him back. I think that's how we ended up with Roma as the Fourth Horseman, but that sucked. Savio Vega, my God, this is something that is lesser known, but it's still worth mentioning here. Savio Vega being the mystery replacement for Shawn fucking Michaels in that 8-man tag team match at No Way Out in 98, the month before WrestleMania. Michaels had a bad back. He couldn't go. And, like, who's going to be the mystery partner, right? And it turns out to be Savio Vega, who may have already, and I don't remember, but he may have already wrestled on the show earlier that night as part of Los Boricuas. And he comes out in that match. God, was that terrible. The gobbledygooker Survivor Series is an obvious one. Hatching out of the giant egg, right? That was terrible. The anonymous Raw GM, Vince McMahon's bastard son. I mean, who can forget August 1st warning in TNA? I'm still torn on whether it's the greatest or the worst, just based on all the wrestler reactions when Tito Ortiz walked out. But yeah, generally speaking, you don't get a very good payoff to these mystery angles. And Ron from Glen Cove, New York. I saw this on X. And I wanted to ask you the same. Is Ricky Steamboat against Macho Man Randy Savage from WrestleMania 3 the greatest match of all time? Ron, it's not even the greatest match at WrestleMania. It's not even the greatest Ricky Steamboat match. You can pick any of the matches from his trilogy with Ric Flair in 89. But it's a great match. But it's certainly not, in my opinion, the greatest match of all time. Not in a world where Bret Hart against Steve Austin exists from WrestleMania 13. You know, not in a world where Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker exist from WrestleMania 25, or their Hell in a Cell match in 1997, or Omega against Okada. There are lots of matches I would put in front of that one. You can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com, with any questions or comments or inquiries. So let me brief you guys on the plans here as we are barreling towards the end of 2024, heading into a brand new year. We got some announcements here. The annual prediction show. This is the plan right now. The annual Sound Off prediction show, where I look back on everything I got right and wrong this year, and I have predictions for next year. The plan right now is for that to be next Sunday. So that would be episode 893. The year in review and end of the year awards is planned for the following week, which would be the 29th. That would be episode 894. Plus, we'll have World's End Fallout and Wrestle Dynasty predictions. So that'll all be on episode 894. That's the last Sound Off of the year, officially. the last show of the year is going to be on New Year's Eve. And I will be live on YouTube for another New Year's Eve stream. That's going to be Tuesday night, December 31st, counting down the top matches of 2024. So not only are we going to ring in the new year together, but I'll do my top matches countdown on that stream as well. And then it'll be a brand new year, and we get to start from scratch, and that'll be hopefully our biggest and best year yet. So anyway, that's the current plan. If that changes or I move things around, I'll let you guys know. But just so you know, there's going to be plenty of content. I'm not going away. I'm not going on vacation. I don't know what that is. I don't even know the meaning of the word. I probably should, though. I'm going on very little sleep right now, and I'm sick. But I will be here, and there will be a lot of content, and I hope you appreciate it, and I hope you enjoy it. So until next time, episode 893, that'll be next Sunday. And of course, I'm live on Monday night this week. I'm live with JD on his channel for Tuesday Night Titans on Tuesday, and then Wednesday night for Dynamite. No SmackDown stream this week, since there's a House of Glory show, so just remember that. But that is where you can find me. So be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week. I'm going to go put up some hot tea, and I will see you back here for more Sound Off very soon. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
I look at what Triple H is doing with Shinsuke Nakamura right now. All due respect to Shin, the spot that he now finds himself in as the United States champion on SmackDown, that's the fucking spot that Chad Gable should be. Do I have any faith that he's going to suddenly rebound and go on a win streak, or he's going to end up with the United States championship? I don't. All the times that I thought, okay, this is going to be Chad Gable's moment. This is the story to tell. This is the direction I think that this is going to go in. Oh, he certainly has to win the title here. Oh, no, no, no. He didn't win there, but he has to win the title there. He comes out a loser. That poor little girl he's got at home. Never forget the tears in her eyes when daddy got beat by Gunther. Every time this guy goes in there, I picture his daughter at home, and all of a sudden she's watching the show and she's all happy to see her dad challenging for a championship or wrestling in the main event, and he loses again. Ooh, poor girl's gonna be traumatized. Her father never wins. Probably gets picked on at school, this poor girl.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
Since 2007.
Bringing you the good,
the bad,
and the ugly. Check out the weekly live streams, bonus content for subscribers, and follow The Solid Monster on Facebook, Instagram, and X. The Solid Monster.
I love you, Solo.